ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
It is a scene that could be straight out of the perfect family photo album. You've got children and parents and grandparents sitting down for Christmas lunch. They're clinking their drinks and there's big smiles all round.
But it does look like a family that's turning for a family photograph around the table. And they're all seemingly toasting whoever they're looking at with their glasses.
But when this image was made, around 200 years ago, it actually caused quite a stir, a little hint of controversy. And ultimately, people just loved it.
The reaction in 1843 to this card was amazing. People were looking at this image of Christmas, and it warmed their hearts, and it made them excited for the season.
Because it turns out that this picture I'm describing, it is the first mass-produced Christmas card. And it was such a novelty and, frankly, a delight that it sparked an annual tradition that runs to this day.
Essentially, this season's greeting lifted spirits and inspired a whole group of people that received these cards to send out their own cards the next year.
I'm Mark Vanell, and this is the story of a really busy man and how his laziness sparked a global pastime that we still have today. And yes, no one saw it coming.
The BBC and others and Smithsonian Institute of the United States call me Doc Holliday because I've written 11 different Christmas books. And so I have somehow morphed into being the guy everybody turns to when they want an answer about either Christmas traditions or Christmas songs.
See, I was going to call you Father Christmas, but Doc Holliday is legitimately better.
Yeah, I kind of like that. It's with a name like Ace, it goes with kind of that Doc Holliday kind of thing. Yeah.
This voice you're hearing here, this is Ace Collins, or Doc Holliday. Actually, honestly, whatever you prefer, I don't mind. And as you can hear, he is the guy to talk to about anything Christmas related.
My grandmother made Christmas very special, from the blue lights on her cedar tree to all of the food that she cooked to having oodles and oozles of presents wrapped underneath the tree. We always had extra places at the table because she would find somebody in that little town that didn't have family coming in, and she would invite them over. I've always been a person, even dating back to childhood, who wanted to know the stories behind things. I always wondered why. And I got to thinking as a kid, I wonder what the story behind that song is, that Christmas carol, or I wonder what the story behind that Christmas tradition is. Why do we do certain things?
Yes, why do we do certain things at this time of year, including why do we write Christmas cards? In fact, bazillions of them, and post them all around the world. Well, to understand that, you need to go back to the 19th century in England. And actually, Christmas was a little different back then.
1840 was the dramatic change in Christmas in places like England, Australia, America, and others. Up until that time, Christmas was kind of Mardi Gras on steroids, using an American term. It was an opportunity for people to go out drinking and partying. It was not a safe time for children and women. As a matter of fact, people in the United States find it amazing that until about 1840, Congress met on Christmas Day. It wasn't even a holiday. Extra police were out to do all the carousing. And that's because it was celebrated the same day as the winter solstice. We all came from a Roman background when they established Christmas on December 23rd. It was a time of drinking and partying, and so Christmas turned into a time of drinking and partying. Oliver Cromwell even outlawed Christmas in England for a while because of all the violence.
It is true. The Puritans prohibited Christmas until the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. Christmas was officially illegal, but that's by the by. We are in 1840, so, you know, different time. And we've got a royal marriage that has changed everything. So you've got Queen Victoria, and she's married to a German, who is also her cousin, Prince Albert.
And when Albert came to England, Buckingham Palace, he brought with him all of those Eastern European traditions. And suddenly it became a holiday that focused on family and slowly changed from being this wild drinking party where women and children stayed home and they had to have extra police out in Australia and the United States and other places that traced their roots back to Great Britain. Suddenly it became much more like the German holiday of gathering and giving presents and having Father Christmas, Santa Claus, Kris Kringle, wherever you were in various places, come. And so Prince Albert brought all of these wonderful traditions, and suddenly the people in the other English-speaking countries started to adapt them. So it was a wild holiday until about 1840.
Okay, so when we talk about it changing, so I've got this image of what it was like before, which is like it's a hectic party and maybe a bit on the dangerous side. But now it's kind of perceived as this kind of warm, fuzzy, kid-orientated event. Like, what are the sorts of things that we start to see change in that moment that we would recognize?
Family gatherings. The thing that we would probably recognize the most are gifts. Suddenly it became a commercial holiday, and the gifts do tie to the gifts the wise men bought. I mean, it is an old tradition, but it wasn't a tradition that many people in English-speaking countries recognized until the 1840s. So buying gifts for others, you know, you looked at the Eastern Europeans had candles on trees, which eventually by 1880, 1890 would become lights. In the United States, there was a Thanksgiving song called Jingle Bells. It was actually, if you think about it, an 1840s Beach Boys song, because it was talking about teenagers trying to impress girls by drag racing one-horse sleighs. If you think about the lyrics, I mean, it really is. I mean, you know, it's wild. But
I'm never going to listen to that song the same way again.
You know, which proves things haven't changed much. Yeah. But anyway, that song was so popular in Medford, Massachusetts, where it was sung at a Thanksgiving service, that it came back and was sung at Christmas, and that went all around the United States. And suddenly, this U.S. version, and of course, we're looking at winter, y'all aren't, but that U.S. version of this snow-covered landscape with the sleds and all that was born. And so we actually owe that image in the United States, Great Britain, and other places to a Thanksgiving song.
Ah.
So not all Christmas traditions were actually born at Christmas time.
So we've got this changing shape of Christmas, and then this particular gentleman steps into the story, Sir Henry Cole. How would you describe Sir Henry Cole?
When you talk about Henry Cole, picture him as a typically dressed 1840s Brit. I mean, literally with the whiskers, the lamb chop sideburns, the hair that wasn't combed, the proper Edwardian coat with the white shirt. He was somebody who walked around looking like a British gentleman. He was not a handsome man. He was just an ordinary looking, short, kind of dumpy creature. But he had a mind that was curious. Henry Cole had that curiosity of a child, and therefore he kept learning and growing and thought, oh gosh, I've got to learn how to do architecture. Oh gosh, I need to learn how to do painting. Oh gosh, I need to learn more about music and opera.
This endless curiosity, it landed him a lot of jobs. And I do mean a lot.
He studied in his spare time painting under a great artist who was a watercolorist named David Cox. And he was a good artist, not a great artist, but a good artist. But he learned all the different painting techniques and became an art critic. Then he started hanging out with people who knew great authors, and he was hanging out with Shelley and Peacock and other best-selling authors of the time, and became a writer, and he was a critic of both art and music. He just had all of these different careers going on to the point where he created a pseudonym where he could have more careers and they wouldn't know it was him. he had all these different pseudonyms that he wrote under. He was the editor of a newspaper. He wrote editorials under a different name, not his own, because he didn't want to get in trouble because he was supposed to be doing all these government jobs and he didn't want them to think he was slacking off. He set up enterprises. He actually invented one of the best-selling teapots in all of Great Britain under one of his pseudonyms. He wrote books under pseudonyms about architecture and sculpture. He wrote about tombs. He was fascinated by tombs. He helped decorate Westminster Abbey. He lobbied the government for improvements in everything from industrial design to safety concerns in industry. He actually created 5 different art museums. I mean, this was a guy who had his fingers in everything. And now you understand why in 1843, when all these people were writing him, he didn't have time to write them back.
So we've got a guy here who has 11 million jobs. And I will say, I actually feel lazy just listening to you list off all those jobs.
I do too.
Multiple lives. And with each one of those, at a time when Christmas is at its ascendancy, it's becoming this event where people, you know, it's becoming something that people in high society engage in. And that suddenly means he's getting all of this correspondence, right? He's getting all of these letters. Like, give me a picture of, do we have a sense of just how much correspondence this poor guy was facing?
I know he had over 1,000 that he had to answer in December that he didn't have time to answer. And so that is when he decided to have an artist come up with a Christmas card for him. It was a little very simple drawing. It wasn't anything elaborate, done in full color and had it printed on cardstock, wishing people, you know, the season's greetings of the time, a Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas, or very simple greeting, wishing you, you know, just to have a happy holiday. And he sent that out. And that image, and there were 3 different images, but the main image was of a family with a goose gathered around a table where everyone had a glass of wine, including the children, and that's where the controversy eventually came in.
Yeah, so it turns out Victorian England was not so crash hard on underage drinking. For broader context around that, this was the height of something known as the temperance movement, where drunkenness was seen as public enemy number one, and this idea that it would lead to immorality and poverty and neglecting the children. However, despite this relatively minor controversy, Cole's Christmas card, it was still a massive hit.
Everyone who got the card thought it was better than a letter. I mean, they were impressed because—
Well, it's got pictures. It's way better than a letter.
Yeah, and he hand-wrote, you know, one-line greeting in his name at the bottom, and, you know, wishing each one of them a Merry Christmas. By the way, one of them, or Happy Christmas in England, they didn't say Merry Christmas. But one of the people he sent a card to was his grandmother, and that card was recently sold at auction for £22,000. That original card did. So it's become quite the collector's item. But he sent these out, and people were just, they felt they were so special to get one of these thousand cards. So he had created something without knowing it that people treasured more than the gifts or anything else that Christmas. His cards were the talk of British society.
So this is intriguing to me, right? Because it could just be me, but I instinctively think sending a card is less personal than handwriting out a letter. But at that moment, the novelty of it is sort of superseding the time it takes to write a letter. Am I interpreting that correctly?
I think you're spot on. I believe it's seeing that image in that card, the color image in the middle, and then the 2 images on each side, along with the greeting, was something they had never seen before. And so it didn't matter that there wasn't much writing or on the card. It mattered they had something that was really unique they had never gotten before. To give you an example how popular it was, over 100 of those people who received cards went to the very same print shop the next year and used the very same art and sent out their own cards with that same message on it to their friends. So they didn't even get new art. They just used the same one over and over again. So in 1844, people in several sections of the world were getting the same card that these special 1,000 people did in 1843.
The weird thing is, it honestly looks like a Christmas card you could buy today. So on the left, you've got what looks like a grandma and a father and a child with some food. Pretty sure they've got some freshly baked bread. On the right, a mum holding a newborn baby. There's this other woman putting a blanket over them for warmth. And in the middle is a happy family sharing a meal with goblets of wine and looking out at you and smiling. And remember, Henry Cole didn't just print these cards. He commissioned an artist to make this design. So he knew what he wanted to portray.
He never talked about why he chose that piece of art or why he commissioned that piece of art. But I believe, based on what I know about him, he was trying to impress the Queen, probably, because over 3 years now, she had had that kind of celebration and it was spreading across England. And so he was trying to show everyone that people were celebrating just like the Queen and Prince Albert were celebrating. So I think he was capturing what the royal family in England had started that was now quickly taking over the entire of the UK.
And yes, Queen Victoria was one of the 1,000 people who received one of Cole's Christmas cards. You do just wonder whether he realised the impact that it'll have. I mean, just think about how many cards you have received or sent over the years.
I honestly believe he had no clue at the time. Now, think about this, though. One of the things that he was assigned to do by the British government that I didn't mention was modernize the post office. So essentially, he created something that would in turn fuel buying stamps at post offices and then create greeting card companies too. I don't think when he did it, he had any concept of what this was going to lead to. But as he was working with the post office, when he sent those 1,000 in, the cards in, he was actually buying stamps and using the very service that he was helping to modernize at the time.
So remember how Cole's first Christmas card was quite stripped back in terms of how much writing was on it? And it really was that image that struck people. Well, eventually this minimalist Christmas card blended with the letter writing of the day, and the Christmas card was filled out with sort of updates of what's going on with the family and well wishes.
The Christmas card ultimately became something that people wrote long, long notes in. If you could look at my grandmother's cards from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, none of them just are signed. They're talking about everything that's happened in the last few months and telling my grandmother all about it. So because people were separated by long distances in Australia, America, and other places, the Christmas card became a way that they could handwrite in those cards what was going on in their lives and kind of update people. It really did become a way of annual communication. You know, your idea of writing the letter, the postcard essentially was quickly turned into a letter within 20 years inside that card, because postal services were so cheap around the world. And two, starting in the 1860s and 70s, you literally could buy a Christmas card for a penny.
Do you think the Christmas card sort of crystallized and maybe solidified some of the iconography that we now associate with Christmas?
I believe so. I mean, your first images of Christmas, because it happened before we even had photography, were done in that pieces of art, appeared in those pieces of art we saw in Christmas cards. You know, I've written a lot about cards and the images of Christmas and all these things when I've done talk about Christmas traditions. Currier and Ives, who are probably the best known of creating those kind of scenes, initially created those for calendars and for Christmas cards. And so the image of Christmas in the United States that was captured by Hollywood in movies about what Bing Crosby sang about in White Christmas and others wouldn't have happened without those initial cards. And the cards of the 1800s and early 1900s were rarely religious cards. They were actually scenes of sleighs and winter and jingle bells and families like the original Cole card and others. And so they were things that captured the season to the point where they covered not only Christmas, but by having season's greetings or happy holidays written on them, which a lot of them did, you also were welcoming in the new year on January 1st.
That's fascinating, because you know how there's this annual kind of controversy about, you know, people saying season's greetings or happy holidays as though they're taking the Christ out of Christmas. It's a war on Christmas. It's actually quite old. It goes way, way back, doesn't it?
It goes back. As a matter of fact, the term Xmas is frowned upon a great deal, but the first 100 years of the church, the Catholic Church always spelled Christmas Xmas, because X was the first letter of Christ's name, and ink and paper were very, very expensive, and so they saved room wherever they could, and so they wrote Xmas. Huh, and so if you went back 1900 years to, say, Paul, Timothy, and those people in the New Testament, and you showed them Xmas, they would immediately know what it meant. It meant worship Christ. And so Xmas has gotten a bad name now, but for 1,000 years, it was how the church spelled it. Merry Christmas is kind of a term that has fallen upon, you've got to use this term, but in truth, if you look at Christmas cards from the 1940s and 50s and 60s, most of them had season's greetings, happy holidays, things like that written on them, and no one at that time felt that was controversial at all. They just understood that there were a lot of holidays, particularly in the United States and Canada, that happened within a 2 months period of time, be it Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter, and Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And so you had one card that covered it all.
Do you think Sir Henry Cole would have any idea that this thing he did as a life hack, essentially, would become so ubiquitous, would become so meaningful for people all this time on?
I think because he lived to 1882, he figured it out. you know, if he had died in 1845, he would have had no idea, you know, but I think he figured it out.
Now, I understand you yourself are a bit of a prodigious writer of Christmas cards. I've heard that you send like more than 100 each year. Is that right?
About 140. Yeah, 140.
140. That's very specific. Why do you love writing Christmas cards so much?
And I do them different ways every year. For starters, I use a Christmas card as you kind of alluded to it. I don't just write my name in a Christmas card. If I'm sending a Christmas card to someone, they have made an impact of some kind in my life, and I thank them for that impact. It may have been something to do with my career. It may have been something I had in my personal life. It may have been a teacher I had 50 years ago. But each one of them means something, or I wouldn't be sending them a card. So it seems hollow to me not to tell that person what they mean to me. So they become something that is both a thank you and a tribute, something that I hope encourages them to continue to have a profound impact on others, thanks to me saying thank you for what they've meant to my life. And so I guess I look upon Christmas cards as a way to encourage people. I also tend to haunt antique malls, look online and find Christmas cards from the 20s and 30s and 40s that were never sent out, complete with their yellow envelopes. And I will send people Christmas cards that are 60, 70, 80 years old to show them what Christmas cards looked like during World War II, or what they looked like during the Great Depression in the 1930s, or what they looked like in the 1950s. And so they're getting something that is not just off the shelf. It's something that I've searched for and I'm sharing with them, that's kind of a one-off, something that nobody has seen a card like that in, you know, in 50, 60, 80 years.
Ace Collins, Doc Holliday, Father Christmas, all of the monikers, thank you so much for doing the No One Saw It Coming with me.
Hey, thank you, and y'all have a mighty Christmas.
So, now you know who you have to thank for your annual hand cramp after writing all those Christmas cards. In our next episode, next week, you'll hear why the nativity scene is everywhere. I'll give you a hint, it involves a 13th century invention.
Everyone knows the nativity scene that we get on Christmas cards every year from our dentist. But this scene that we know and love is not really canonical to the original Bible. It comes to us from 1223. St. Francis of Assisi is a very popular saint in the Middle Ages, and he sets up what is thought to be the first kind of nativity play. They conduct mass, they dress up as Mary and Joseph, and they have a wooden effigy of the baby Jesus. And this is the first reenactment of this scene. So his ideas are incredibly popular over the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. And he's particularly interested in connecting people with religion rather than with money and worldly goods.
The mystery behind the nativity scene next week on No One Saw It Coming. And of course, you will be able to hear it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. The sound engineer was Angie Grant. I'm Mark Fennell, and No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National, and I'll be back with a brand new episode next week. Until then, bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.